Welcome to In Conversation With from the Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce. Supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Presented by Stuart Elford. Recorded at Fresh Air Studios in Plymouth.
Hello there, I'm Stuart Elford, Chief Executive of Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce, with another edition of our In Conversation With podcast, where we interview famous people, politicians, characters in business, people from around the region. And today I'm joined by a relatively new person to the region, businessman, entrepreneur and philanthropist, Angus Forbes. Welcome, Angus.
Thanks, Stuart. Great to be here.
Now, forgive me, but most people in Plymouth, if they've heard of you, will know you as Mr. Darcy Bustle, and we'll come back to that. But what brought you to Plymouth?
Well, Stuart, most times in our relationship between Darcy and myself is that Darcy leads and I follow. In fact, I'm a member of the Yard Behind Club,
you,
as I like to call it.
Right.
You know, carrying her bags a yard behind, being the
like
husband.
Like the Duke of Edinburgh. That
exactly.
Used to have to walk
he was our patron, exactly, of that fictitious society.
Yeah.
But on this one occasion, it was me.
Was it?
That led us to Plymouth. I'd given a talk at the university on a subject that I was very passionate about, which was quite esoteric, quite out there, global governance of the biosphere.
I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. Yes.
And I wrote a book about it. And then they very kindly invited me back.
Yeah.
Darcy subsequently got invited to the university and she gave a talk and footage and everything like that. Yeah. She then did a little thing at the Millfields Academy, it? Here, the red one. Anyway, there was, in full transparency, is that we got very lucky with a company I'd invested in Australia called Guzman y Gomez. Mm-hmm. It's a Mexican fast food chain.
Yes. I was going to say it all started with nachos, but
It did. Tacos, exactly.
Tacos, sorry, yeah.
And burritos. Anyway, we sold some shares in that. So we got some money, which we didn't deserve, in truth. We're just very, very fortunate. And so I said to Darcy, well, you know, what would you like to do? And she said, well, we're British, well, Australian, British in my case. Mm. Let's do something in Britain. And I said, great. Well, how about Plymouth? And she's like, why Plymouth? I said, well, most beautiful harbour in Britain. And she loves the water. And I think there's opportunities in some property there without, you know, just being here to make money, but to do places up, which is what we're more interested in. And I know this sounds a little bit corny or whatever, but I felt there was work to be done in the city. And that's what's attractive to us. If we could help in any way alleviate poverty or, you know, even one person, get one person out of poverty and into an apprenticeship. So we felt very strongly about those things. Beautiful coastal city, opportunity to do something we knew a little bit about, which was property, and the opportunity to help if we could. And those three things brought us to Plymouth.
Great. And have you had a warm welcome?
We've had a very warm welcome, to be honest. Good. Thank you.
I wonder what you're going to say then. You gave me a look and I thought he's going to say, no, it's been dreadful.
No, people have been great. I think with my bit of Australian accent and everything, and then of course people are naturally quite nice to Darcy.
Funny that. Yeah.
Funny that. But no, people have been very warm here, really nice, really down to earth, which is what we love because we like to think we're like that. They've been really great. And truthfully, Stuart, I thought, oh, we'll buy a property and enjoy this incredible city, the beautiful view, and that will be it. And then we thought, nah, that's not enough. And Darcy became chair of the theatre.
Yeah.
And we thought, okay, well, that's it. You know, we're doing our bit. And then we're like, no, it's not enough. What can
there's
we do?
More.
And there's more to do. So that's why we got some other projects as well, which we can
talk about. Well, I'll be roping you into the chamber before too long, I'm sure. You've lived in a lot of, as you describe, remote coastal cities, Adelaide, Sydney, Port Moresby, Hong Kong, Hamburg, and now Plymouth, saving the best till last, obviously. Does that mean you'll be leaving us or do you think you're here to stay?
I don't know the answer to that, to be absolutely honest. I mean, most of those cities, except for Adelaide, were where my father was posted to as a trade commissioner for Australia. So he was an Australian diplomat. So our first posting was Hong Kong in 1970. Terribly exciting to be in Hong Kong in 1970.
I'll bet.
The Queen Elizabeth sank there, was in the harbour. It caught fire. The typhoons that used to roll through Hong Kong, you know, as a young kid, it was incredible. Our second posting was Hamburg. That was 1974 to 1976. That was very interesting because, of course, that was West Germany, not the combined Germany. The capital was in Bonn. So the ambassador was in Bonn, but all the trade commissioners were in Hamburg because of the industrial heartland, the biggest port. And then the third posting was Port Moresby, which had only become independent in 1974. 5, I think, had become independent because it was Papua, wasn't it, in the north, and New Guinea in the south. And they merged and they became independent. And we were there in 1979, so only 4 years after independence. Mm-hmm. I went to boarding school in Adelaide and my parents went to Belgrade. There's a story, actually.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid in Adelaide, about 14, 15, I had to go home to Belgrade for my school holidays. So there were no international flights out of Adelaide then.
Right.
So my first flight was to go backwards to Melbourne, southeast of Adelaide. There I had to get on the Qantas jet because, of course, Qantas was publicly owned by the government and my father was a government employee. So I got on the government jet. We flew back over Adelaide to Darwin, Darwin, Singapore, Singapore, Athens, Athens, Belgrade.
Oh, wow.
That was my
commute. Was it worth it?
It was very worth it. I used to carry my report card unopened because I'd beat the post.
Right.
So the school used to give me my report card. So anyway, that was Belgrade. And then my father and mother took a double posting in Auckland.
Right.
And when I was at university.
Lovely city.
Wonderful. Went to Auckland. So most of the cities were due to my parents and my upbringing there. So we won't
but be. Now it's you. You've chosen Plymouth.
Yeah, it's a great town, this town.
And I know you're interested in property and have bought some in Plymouth.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of thing are you looking at?
What I've done, I normally cock most things up. But this is my theory. This is my theory anyway, is that I've overlaid Sydney onto Plymouth.
Yeah.
And Sydney I know extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, Plymouth trades at about 1/12 of the price of Sydney.
As in property prices.
Property prices. Yeah, yeah. So Sydney trades at £1,200 square foot.
Mm-hmm.
London's at £900 square foot. And Plymouth is typically around £150 square foot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's around about a ninth or tenth or whatever it is of Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
So we bought some property in what are some of the best areas, to be honest.
Mm.
Mount Wise with the view. I mean, not everything's about property prices. We should talk, actually, if you wouldn't mind, in a minute, Stuart, about property and what happens if it goes up, making sure that the equality gap does not widen.
Exactly that. We don't want to leave people behind.
Absolutely not. The first value line of the Sustainability Development Goals is leave no one behind. And the number two one is reach for the furthest behind first.
Right.
I think those are brilliant goals, brilliant value system. Darcy and I certainly believe in that.
Mm.
But anyway, just coming back to finish the property. So
yeah, you bought in Mount Wise.
Mount Wise, because in Sydney, that's a suburb called Vaucluse.
Yeah.
We bought a little place in Durnford Street, just near to where we are here, because in Sydney, that's either Point Pipe or Darling Point.
Next to Royal William Yard with all the attractions.
Exactly. And it being a dead end peninsula into the harbour, extremely attractive over time. And then we bought a place not on the front of the Hoe, but back a block. And that's like being on the back of a place called Double Bay in Sydney.
Right.
Just away from the water a bit.
Okay. And you mentioned to me before about sight lines. You said Plymouth sight lines are sometimes better than Sydney's. What do you mean by that?
Sydney Harbour, most people say this is the most beautiful harbour in the world.
Mm.
And it's hard to disagree with that.
I've sailed in it and it is beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Without a doubt.
It's probably, well, depending on how much of the Tamar you take, but it's probably about 3-4 times the size of our Sound and Tamar, that sort of size. But Plymouth's got to be up there in terms of sheer beauty.
Mm.
And what happens if the property market does grow here is that sight lines are very important, and we haven't got to that here in Plymouth, but I suspect we might. If you have a view of the water, it's classed in a certain category, and then if you have a view of where the water hits the shoreline, it's classed in a different category. And what that's all about is that if someone wants to build a house in front of you that blocks your view, the council has to make a ruling, because your property value is going to drop.
Mm.
They have to make a ruling on which bit of the view is the most valuable to you.
Right.
Is it sheer water? Is it where the land hits the sea? Is it Mount Edgecombe? They've got to have a grading system so they can curtail the ambition of the new builder in favor of the existing properties. Because otherwise what happens, you play what I call reverse dominoes.
Mm.
If you have 5 houses on a hill, all with a view, and the lowest one goes up a story.
Everyone else, the second one
has to go up a story. The third one has to go up a story.
Yeah,
and everyone goes backwards like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, in Sydney, it's got to an unfortunate extent where people poison trees. because the view is too valuable. So if they remove the tree, they get the view, which means their house price goes up to an extent that copper nails can only be sold to authorized shipbuilders.
Right. I've heard of this. You put a copper nail in and it poisons a tree. Correct. I've heard of that. Correct. I don't know where I heard that.
Yeah.
Well, that's tragic, isn't it?
I think in Plymouth's case, our house ownership here is only 59% of the population. The UK average is 65.2%.
Right.
So we need to have more people owning their own homes, for sure. And we need to have more social housing and preferably mechanisms so that they can go on and own their own homes, right? But having house prices rise a little bit is still a good thing a little bit to me, because the quality developers will come in. Then the stipulation by the council or the leadership group of the city will be that you have to do, for example, 40% social housing or 30% social housing. Yeah. So if a big developer comes into, let's say, Stonehouse, that would be great.
Is that what they call Section 106 or something, obligations?
Yeah. You know more than me.
No, no.
But you start to get higher quality developers come in with the mandatory component of, so good quality social housing. So having house prices go up a little bit in Plymouth, I think, will really help. And it'll drive employment as well. If you're unfortunately on the what I would call the dole, so unemployment benefits, and you are suffering a lack of hope because you've been knocked down, a house in Renown Street, let's say, right, Keyham, going north from Keyham, right? Yeah. If that's worth £150,000 or £200,000, it's indifferent to you. You're never going to buy that house.
Mm.
Never. It could be worth £1 million. You're never going to be able to get that house because you won't be getting a loan and you haven't got the ambition to do it, right? Mm. So if that house was worth a little more and this economic activity in Plymouth was greater and you are employed and your partner is employed and you're both on 35 grand, then you're on 70 grand, you'll be able to afford the house at 200,000. So I didn't want to make this conversation about property, and property is not everything. And I'm not here to say, hey, we should really have an aggressively inflating property market. But we got to look at every mechanism to reduce inequality. And we got to look at every mechanism to empower people in Plymouth. And we got to look at every possible mechanism to halve poverty in this town. And to me, having a larger economy, if it's part of that solution, then we should have a larger economy.
Well, I completely agree, of course. I suppose I just want to ask you one more thing about property. Is Plymouth making the most of its land and portfolio? I mean, you would think there's more to be done. I mean, we've got some areas of Plymouth that are sort of quite industrial right next to the water, where you think that would have greater value as residential, for example.
There are many things I love about Plymouth, but one of the things is when you walk, you get sight lines, don't you? I walked up to Keyham, the park up at Keyham. I could not believe the view due north from Keyham. I was like, oh my goodness, you got these rolling hills.
Yeah.
Or you're on Mutley, right, in the Mutley High Street, and you get a glimpse of Cornwall.
Yeah.
It's stunning having that gently rolling hills of Plymouth. What I would say is that I don't think we should be afraid of beauty. If we're going to be poor, or a little bit poorer than we should be here in Plymouth, and I don't think we have to be poor, let's be beautiful, you know what I mean? And if we're going to be poor and struggling a little bit or whatever, let's at least be beautiful. Let's knock down some ugly buildings and plant some trees. And there's no embarrassment in that.
Yeah.
We did a survey, which I don't want to go on too much about if you don't mind on this occasion, but I would like to say that we did a survey. We commissioned an independent surveyor called QRS to ask Plymouthians about their city. And we had a survey response of 342 people. And the number one thing that aggravated them above everything else was the city centre.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I do think that Abercrombie, we are living with the legacy of Abercrombie to our detriment. I know he meant well, and he was essentially a student of Haussmann and the wide boulevards that Haussmann created in Paris. But the fact is our city centre is too big.
Yeah, absolutely. I think most people,
everyone knows that, right?
Yeah.
I met a nice guy the other day called Johnny Harris. Johnny used to be the head of Macquarie's property division, so an aggressive Australian investment bank. So he's seen a lot of cities in his time as the head of property at Macquarie Bank. And I said, would you come down to Plymouth, please, mate? And he said, yeah, no worries. So he came down and I took him what I call the fast Plymouth tour.
Yeah.
And which is, and please excuse me, listeners, because you're all, you know, berate me, but I'm just a Australian oik. So we get in the car and I said, you don't understand Plymouth if you don't drive up the Devonport Wall. Mm-hmm. If you don't drive Absolutely. Up that wall, you don't understand Plymouth
yep.
because of the history of Devonport. Up to the A38, down to Marsh Mills, along the embankment, and finish up near Armada Way, and then walk into the city along Armada Way. It gives you a feel. Of course, you haven't been to Mutley, you haven't been up to Dereford, but you've got a feel.
I know what you mean, yeah.
So we get to Royal Parade and he looks left and right and he goes, okay, that's Portland stone that Asta got for us yep. incredibly, you know, when there was no Portland stone to get, he got it. And then he gets to New George, he looked left and right. By the time we got to Cornwall Street, his jaw was on his chest. He turned to me and he said this almost verbatim. He said, Angus, I've been in a lot of cities around the world. I have never seen such disproportion between the size of the commercial space, the size of the pedestrian area, and the size of the populace.
Yeah. So it makes it seem barren and empty and... Yeah.
It's Stalinist.
Yeah, yeah.
Armada Way I call the Spaniard's Revenge. I reckon someone got into Abercrombie's office, who was a Spaniard, and said, you know how you guys stuffed us all those hundreds of years ago?
If you Here's
could,
our revenge.
If you could build a corridor that's 1,400 yards long and 60 yards wide in a city that gets southwesterly winds of 50 knots for 3 months of the year, that will stuff Plymouth for the next 400 years. It's the Spaniard's Revenge. Right. I mean, there are little old ladies in the northeast corner of Armada Way who are still picking themselves off buildings. You know, they just get blown in that direction. Armada Way is very impressive, of course, but gosh, it's wide, isn't it? Yeah. So somehow I think we need to work the city better. I think there is a solution, but there are far better town planners and city architects than me to talk about that. Perhaps if you'll indulge me, I'd like to talk about Stonehouse. And this may sound very controversial, and everybody has their views, don't they? But to live in the lowest 1% socioeconomically in Britain, in a location that's so well serviced within the city, that being Stonehouse, you know, to have Victoria Park to the north and to have the harbour to the south is an aberration. There's something we have to do there. Everyone have their view. I personally think that we should pedestrianise the centre of Union Street. Mm-hmm. Union Street was created to bring the three towns together, wasn't it? Mm. But for Stonehouse to thrive, it needs to be connected to itself. North Stonehouse needs to be connected to South Stonehouse. Mm. And bugger the rest of us, we can drive around. Mm. It needs to have its own community, its own sense of being. And it's around the new Palace Theatre, isn't it? Mm. And that's...
Which is very symbolic because...
Very symbolic.
Let go.
Listed. To me, I would actually pedestrianise that section and then we'll get the energy going and its own identity going. Mm. And the brilliant work of people like Hannah and Wendy at Nudge and Jarbo can really manifest itself as a community.
Very interesting.
The conversation continues shortly. But first, Stuart Elford and the Chamber of Secrets.
Well, welcome to the section of the show that is called Stuart Elford's Chamber of Secrets. And this part of the show, we ask our guest, who today is Sir Gary Streeter, to pull out of the very odd-looking bowl in front of you a question that has been submitted that hopefully is a bit of fun, hopefully it's nothing dodgy, and just see what you want to answer. So,
okay. So
go for it. Pull out the question and
Let's
see.
Have a question. Of course, it's a long question. That's all.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's a long piece of paper. May not be a long question. Who is your celebrity crush?
Well, there you go.
Well, I've been a lifelong Rod Stewart fan.
You fancy Rod Stewart?
I don't fancy Rod Stewart.
I think they mean crush.
Oh, I see. Okay. My favourite movie is Pretty Woman. I think Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
She's pretty astonishingly beautiful, isn't she?
She's okay.
Not up to your standards, I understand.
Well, my team know that I've been single for a little while now and Keira Knightley hasn't called. I don't know why.
I'm staggered by that. You should check your mobile phone.
it's probably been ringing even now.
It's not working.
So, Gary, thanks for that bit of fun. I really appreciate it.
Follow the Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce on X at chamber_Devon and search for us on LinkedIn. Make sure you don't miss out on future episodes. Hit subscribe now. In Conversation With, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Now, back to the conversation.
So is your desire to shape Plymouth part of the reason you're interested in the idea of an elected mayor. Is that what you think can help Plymouth realise its potential for waterfront, for property and so forth? Is that why you're particularly interested in an elected mayor?
My primary motivation for a directly elected mayor is to remove poverty and, if possible, eradicate violence against women and girls. To do that, we need exceptional teamwork. We need the whole town to be understanding its mission. We need a leader who can unite us in a vision. And the best model in the world is a directly elected mayor. It's the number one model in the world. Sydney, Adelaide, Melbourne, Brisbane, Seattle, San Diego.
New York.
Yeah, New York, Boston, Copenhagen, Bordeaux, Stockholm, Oslo, Valencia, Barcelona. All of these cities have a directly elected mayor. And what that does, it puts people in place above politics. The directly elected mayor must say what they will achieve in their 4 years. Now, I said earlier to have great leaders in that space. The reason why we don't have those great leaders of city is nothing to do with the individuals, nothing to do with the current leader or the previous leaders. All these people have been people who've wanted to serve the city and continue to serve the city. It's the opportunity to be a great leader the structure provides. You need to have the right structure so that it gives them the space. 4 years and a direct mandate from the people. So you get political legitimacy if you got 70,000 Plymouthians voting you into office. So Stuart for directly elected mayor. I can see
it now. That's never
going to happen.
That's never going to happen.
So
but wouldn't
what it works.
The current leader say he is directly elected in the sense that he's elected by the population.
But it's indirectly elected.
Because he is a leader of a party that is elected.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Okay. But would not we end up with the same result in that I'm thinking, and I'm only thinking aloud, but to win an election, you'd almost certainly have to be backed by a political party because that's what they do. They have electoral sort of machines that help this. And are we not just going to end up with the same person with a different title?
No.
Okay. Is it you, Angus?
Absolutely not.
No.
No, because I'm, just to clarify that, absolutely not. I think just to clarify that one point before we come back to the mechanism of why it drives greater leadership, better leadership, is, you know, I'm 58 years old and I've been in Plymouth for 2 years. I think that gives me a legitimate reason to call the town to account and to promote a fresh idea. You know, it means that I've had 56 years outside of Plymouth. I've seen a lot. I've seen a lot of different city structures around the world, but I've also been here long enough to ask a lot of questions of the leadership group, people in religion, in sports, in culture, in the Navy, in the healthcare system. So why are we stuck? And the number one answer is that we have a leadership vacuum. And again, it's nothing to do with Tudor and nothing to do with Richard, nothing to do with Nick, nothing to do with that. It's the mechanism and the space to allow a leader to be the best they can be. So let's go back to why it is different. And it's small margins, but they add up. So let's say that someone wants to run for a directly elected mayor. Point number one is that they can no longer be a councillor. They have to be standing on their own 2 feet. They can be affiliated to a political party, as you said, right? But so they're no longer a councillor. Point number two is that they have to state what they're going to achieve in their 4 years. They're fully accountable. So at the moment, our system is that a political party leader, indirectly elected, can slip in to power without having to say what their objectives are, what their scorecard is. So they're forced to do that. So Andy Burnham says, this is what I will achieve. The baccalaureate for Manchester is one of the things I'm going to achieve for Manchester in the next 4 years, for example. When Richard Parker stood against Andy Street for West Midlands, he promised 150,000 new jobs for the West Midlands in 4 years. So you've got to stand up. So it's direct accountability. The third thing, of course, is direct democracy. So you've got democracy. 70,000 Plymouthians want candidate X or candidate Y. So that's very important. Another factor is responsibility. When you have the title of directly elected mayor for 4 years, everything is on you. 78,000 people in poverty in this town, 11,000 children in poverty, truancy at 28% versus the national average of 16%. The fact that we have 12,000 people waiting for social housing. The tough stuff of Plymouth rests on the shoulders of the directly elected mayor. So that after 4 years, if those stats don't start turning, it's on that person. Another factor is that raw ambition. You know, raw ambition is a thing. You've got to state your ambition, your target. You can be a bit more risk-taking as well. There's another one, which is talent pool. So there's a greater talent pool for a directly elected mayor. So Andy Street, who has just been the directly elected mayor for West Midlands, was the lead partner, senior partner, John Lewis. His opponent, Richard Parker, is a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC. So you tell me which one was Labour and which one was Conservative. The former partner of John Lewis or a current partner of PwC?
And is it not what I would imagine?
Andy was Conservative and Richard was Labour. But Richard's involvement in the Labour Party was only 4 years of policy work when he was a young man. So their credibility is above colour. So those are the attributes which start to add up to why it's the number one model in the world. But I'd like to go a little bit further, if I may. And that is just for the last point. When you look around the world, because they've had this system for 50 years longer than us, you get more independents coming through, as well as the people that are backed by the major parties. So Clover Moore in Sydney, who is a complete and utter rock star, she is 74. She's the directly elected mayor of Sydney City Council. She is an independent. In Seattle, the nine councillors, they have nine councillors for downtown Seattle. They have to be all independent. It's mandated. In Vancouver, the nine councillors, again, have to be at large. They have no wards. So what I think the next iteration is for the mayoral system in Britain, particularly England, sorry, focus on England, is that over the next 20 years, it's really been around for the last 8-9 years in truth. Of course, Ken Robinson came in 1999. The next iteration is more independence.
Okay. So how do we make this happen?
Well, we're lucky because we have a regulation, legislation. We can sign a petition for 5% of the electoral roll, which is just under 10,000, and that would automatically trigger a referendum. And that's what I launched the start of was that process.
And how many signatures do you need?
10,000.
10,000. Are you confident?
People have told me that we will get them, but until it's done.
The proof of the pudding.
Proof of the pudding.
Yeah.
I think for me, Stuart, failure is not trying.
No, I get that. I suppose just before I move off from that, I mean, two quick points. One is the chamber is apolitical, so I'm not making a political point about that. That was a sort of rhetorical, how do we make it happen, as in how do the people make it happen?
Yeah.
And secondly, I just want to ask you very quickly about devolution, your thoughts on that Plymouth's out of the Greater Devon devolution deal?
Certainly, I'm not close enough to that to give an answer that's on the minutiae of Devon. What I believe, when talking about the attributes of a DEM and my history of observing them, I think I can say that I can talk with reasonable confidence. So I hope your listeners will excuse me that maybe the next answer is a little bit more amateur and not so well informed. As I believe it, the Department of Levelling Up offered Devon a tier one devolution deal, which would have meant a pot of money, some planning benefits and some transport benefits, some type of package for that. And up went the leaders of Devon County Council, Torbay City Council and Plymouth City Council up to Westminster, and they declined that offer because the quid pro quo is a directly elected mayor for the whole of Devon, and they decided that they didn't want that for whatever reason. I don't know. And now Devon County Council and Torbay City Council have moved on to this tier two deal that they're cutting right now. I actually think that's going to be great for Plymouth, because if we have our own directly elected mayor for Plymouth, if we get this town rocking, if we get this town to realize its true potential over the next 10 years, we're going to dominate these two counties, right? We're going to be the number one city in these two counties, and the energy is going to start coming into us. So a young person who is unemployed in Newquay is going to want to come to here. Someone who's got a business based in Bodmin is going to want to put it in Plymouth. Someone who thinks that X is a little too boring compared to a very exciting coastal city like Plymouth, is going to want to move to Plymouth. Okay. I completely believe that we will dominate this peninsula. And if there's going to ever be a wider metro mayor of, let's say, Devon and Cornwall, it will be the mayor of Plymouth.
That's an interesting point. I mean, obviously, I represent the whole of Devon. So as long as what's good for Plymouth is good for Devon.
Sorry,
no,
Stuart.
No, not at all. I mean, it's a very interesting point. I mean,
Exeter is great, by the way. I'm just chewing the fat. I'm throwing it around.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, what finally people in business are realising, and, you know, we're working really closely with Exeter Chamber, watch this space, that we've got more in common. It's better to work together. And sometimes what's good for Exeter is actually good for Plymouth. And what's good for Plymouth is good for Exeter. As long as the greater good is served.
For all of your listeners in the rest of Devon, I'm talking so passionately about this because here in Plymouth, we have 30% of our citizens in poverty. So in the last survey in 2019, that was 78,048 citizens.
It's a scandal.
Yeah, it's a scandal.
It's an absolute
and
scandal.
That's in levels IMD1 and IMD2, which are the worst levels of the 7 index of multiple deprivation. Mm. And in Exeter, I believe, don't quote me, but I believe that the percentage of their citizens that are in IMD1 and IMD2 is 4%. Mm. So when I talk so passionately about turning Plymouth around, of course it will benefit Exeter if our economy is twice the size. Mm. It will lift all boats, and Exeter's boat is extremely good and robust and in good shape.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? The rising tide floating all boats.
Exactly.
So I want to just ask a bit about you. So you started as a hedge fund manager in the consumer sector. Is that how you ended up investing in burritos?
I finished my time in the city that way, Stuart.
Yeah.
That's very kind. So after uni in Adelaide, I got on the boat. I flew this modern parlance. I flew to London and I was very lucky. I got a job at a firm called James Capel, which is a stockbroker. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what a share was, Stuart. I really didn't. But what I learned very quickly was to listen, because I wasn't going to survive if I didn't listen fast and learn fast how a stockbroker worked. And God, I was hopeless. But from James Capel, I went to Merrill Lynch, also as a stockbroker. And then finally, I went to a hedge fund called GLG. And there I was also hopeless. I really was. I have suffered the ignominy of having my book taken away from me. Right. That meant the money that I was running as a junior fund manager was taken away from me. That meant someone sat in my seat on a large floor of people with screens, right, and removed all of my positions by ringing up brokers and buy this, sell that. And I had to stand behind them while that occurred. And that occurred at the same time as my wonderful wife gave birth to our daughter, our first daughter, 8 weeks premature. So that week, Darcy was in essentially intensive care. Our Phoebe was in neonatal with a tube up her mouth and a CPAP mechanism keeping her breathing. And my book was taken away from me. I didn't sleep for about 10 days.
Bloody hell.
But anyway, that happened. And thankfully, Darcy and Phoebe survived. And then I finished my career on a slightly a higher note, because after paying my penance for about 2 years of staying at the firm and doing pretty crap jobs at the hedge fund, they finally gave me a book they'd carved out called the Consumer Fund. And that meant I'd go long LVMH and I'd short BMW, for example. Mm. I try and find the better consumer companies and own them, and I could short, because that's what a hedge fund can do. It can bet on the negative bet. It's a very funny mechanism. You sell a share you don't have to go short. That's for another conversation. And you hope that your good shares rise and the ones you've sold actually keep falling or whatever. And I enjoyed that and I made good return on that. And I did that for 4 years and I stopped because I felt I'd paid them back.
Right. And you just thought that's
it. And I stopped with Darcy. Darcy stopped at the Royal Ballet in 2007 and we packed our bags and took our girls to Sydney.
Right. And is that where you got involved in the Mexican food?
And then I was sitting in Sydney and two mates had set up a Mexican food company, a food restaurant called Guzman y Gomez, and they had two stores and I invested when they had two stores. And they were very brilliant businessman, and GYG now has 215 stores.
Slight growth then.
Yeah, good growth. From inception, 18 years.
Briefly, you're involved in a clothing firm in the Southwest now?
Yeah, absolutely. A great little company called Jam Industries.
Yeah.
That was founded by Andrew and Mark Jordan. Mm-hmm. Again, two brothers. And they have, I think, 6 or 7 stores around the Southwest, 2 in Salcombe, 1 in Padstow, St Ives, a couple others. And then they have 1 store on the King's Road in London.
Okay, what sort of clothing?
It's surfwear.
Okay.
Surfwear, sort of lifestyle surfwear, urban meets ocean. A nice jumper with a blue stripe. And yeah, Jam Industries, extremely well run, very passionate. And they're actually looking at Plymouth and not necessarily to open a store just yet, but they would like to do a philanthropic action here in Plymouth. I met them. I said, guys, we've invested in Plymouth. You've got to come to Plymouth. And they said, well, truth be told, Angus, the closest we get to Plymouth is the Sainsbury's at Marsh Mills, where a coffee and a donut cost £1.50, and we do a swap of stock.
Okay.
So all the stores to the east of Plymouth, where we've got excess stock, swap to the ones to the west. So that's as close as we get to Plymouth. And I say, guys, you got to come into town, because this town is going to, you know, really do something special over the next 20 years. So you've got to come in. And they've also fallen in love with it a bit, and now they want to try to help. So we're looking at various charities and seeing how we can support a particular charity by that company.
Great.
The conversation continues shortly. But first, the 60-second charity pitch.
My name is Ian Smith. I'm from Food Plymouth, the city's local sustainable food partnership. We're all about joining up food in all its forms around the social, economic, and environmental dimensions of that. We've been going since 2010. We're members of Plymouth Chamber and very happy to be involved in that work. One of the things that we do is work around food support, food aid, with the Plymouth Food Aid Network, which is a very important expression of what we do, but there's much more to it than that. So we would like to meet and talk with and work with anyone operational in the food space in Plymouth to join everything up as best we can. It's a partnership and a network model. So the partners and the network are absolutely vital to everything that goes on. And we deliver collective impact by joining all of that together to create the best benefits.
Follow the Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce on X at @chamber_Devon and search for us on LinkedIn. Make sure you don't miss out on future episodes. Hit subscribe now. In Conversation With, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Now, back to the conversation.
I want to ask you about other passions of yours, because you're particularly passionate about the environment, and you founded Bankers Without Borders. What is that about?
Thank you. I founded something called Bankers Without Boundaries.
Sorry, Without Boundaries.
No, you're absolutely right. Bankers Without Borders was taken, so we couldn't use it. It was the best name ever because of Médecins Sans Frontières.
Okay.
So everyone wants to copy Médecins Sans Frontières.
I see where it came from. Yeah.
So Bankers Without Borders was taken by a merger between Grameen Bank and JP Morgan into a new entity, Grameen being that micro lending initiative that had occurred in Bangladesh and then India. Anyway, they had the name. I said to myself, well, if you can have Manchester United and Manchester City,
why not?
Why not Bankers Without Borders and Bankers Without Boundaries? So we founded Bankers Without Boundaries. And
what does it do?
What it does is it takes ex-bankers, people who have been in the city, and we structure for free. We try and drive private capital into ultra high-end impact investing projects. And we try and facilitate that, and we do that for free. So we don't make any money out of it. It's all free. So it's probably best served by an example. In Honduras, there are lobster fishermen, and half of them are in boats, and the other half are what are called mosquito fishermen, because they dive like mosquitoes down to get the lobster. They get the lobster. And what happens is that the lobster population suffers because they will get a young female lobster, for example, a lot of eggs, and that's taken away and put in the cooking pot. And also the divers themselves end up getting the bends, and they actually lose limbs, and then ultimately they suffer from premature death. So we heard about the Smithsonian scientist there who would like to try and get all of the mosquito fishermen onto their own boats.
Right.
Then all of the boats would go into the one harbor, and then the Smithsonian scientist could put the young female lobsters back. And that way, not only would the lobster population grow and be healthy, but the human population would be better off as well. So he had no idea how to solve the problem because the cost was going to be $15 million to get all of those new boats. So our brilliant CEO called Rupesh Malani, he stepped in and he went to Honduras, which is no mean feat because Honduras is the murder capital of the world per capita. And he worked out that all the lobster go to the United States. So he asked the government, would you put a lobster export tax on this of, let's say, 2%? They said, yeah, we could do that. So he structured something. So if a funder came in and gave the $15 million, they would get a 25% return that was derived from the export tax on the lobster. And therefore, they get 25% return infinitum or maybe for 10 years on their $15 million investment, which would get all of those lobster fishermen out of the sea and we get a win-win. And we structured that for free. And then we give it back to Smithsonian scientists, say, here's the structure. And they go, what are you doing giving it to me? Why aren't you taking me to Fidelity or to BlackRock or someone and holding my hand? And our view there is no, you have to live on your own. And what's happened is that that Smithsonian scientist has a second cousin at Goldman Sachs and or someone to help them. And then that document is passed down the line and that did get funded.
Wonderful. And are they all environmental type products?
Social and environmental.
Social environmental.
As long as they're the highest possible impact and projects that no one else can fund, that's where we step in.
And you're also involved with global governance of the biosphere. Is that the same as the Global Planet Authority?
Yeah.
So that's the same. Tell us about that.
Stuart, you're indulging me too much.
No, well, I want to know. I mean, it's important stuff.
I wrote a little pamphlet book called Global Planet Authority about 6 years ago. It was just a provocation to ask whether humanity should enter global governance to save a biosphere. Humans have not done that yet. The UN is not in global governance because it has no executive powers. It was quite extraordinary in 1944 when the UN started to be manifested, and then 45, obviously, it came into being at the end of the Second World War. There were advocates for executive power. Eisenhower was a big advocate. Churchill was a big advocate. Mm. Their basic line was, how many world wars do we have to have before we step above the country framework? And isn't that a pertinent question right now,
it's
potentially?
Yeah.
But it didn't win the day. And so the UN became essentially a meeting room. Good to have. Good to have a meeting room so people talk. Better the jaw than war, the old saying is. Mm. But humanity is not into global governance yet above the nation state. And I believe that now that we are running a biosphere with Mother Nature for the first time, we are so powerful as a race that we should seriously consider doing so. Humans have been very efficient in producing governance structures that serve them at a particular time for a particular purpose. Robert Peel and the formation of the police force was such a person. There was huge objection to the forming of a police force in this country and leading the world like we did in doing so. Oh, you're taking away our freedoms. You know, this is craziness.
Exactly. Rejecting them.
Overregulation.
Yeah.
Until so many sons and daughters started getting grotted in the street and then everyone said, hey, we need protection. So we create the governance structures of our time to serve us. In doing so, we allocate a piece of our personal sovereignty. We do that en masse and we enter above the nation state. So what would it take for humanity to go above China, above India, above the United States, above the EU, above Britain, for the very first time? It would probably be 3 billion people clubbing together. You go, well, that will never happen. Well, we now have 5.5 billion people who have mobile phones. And we have, I think, 4 to 4.5 billion who have their own computers. So we now have this collective swarm of citizenship who can talk to each other at that level for the very first time. And indeed, it is that connectivity that precludes such a big action. And I wonder, Stuart, just as a thought, in the first week of COVID, humanity lay flat. We closed the system down. Mm-hmm. Never been done before. They closed an economic system down for about 48 hours. If humanity wants to go past the 14,000 nuclear warheads that we've got, the 50 million soldiers that we've got, if 3 billion people want to go past that, I think their mechanism of choosing will be to lie flat. They will say, we're closing the system down. Mm. And 50 million soldiers, you know, are not going to take out 3 billion people. So we will see if Greta Thunberg, if the next or the third or the fourth iteration of Greta Thunberg, and I suspect it'll be a 22-year-old woman that might take humanity into global governance. Mm. If that person, she will say, enough is enough. 3 billion people, are you with me? We're lying flat. And that's how we're going to force the countries of the world to cede power to one authority that does one job, not for their full manifestation. Countries will still exist, but in that one particular function of protecting a biosphere, they must cede authority to the one unit. That's the idea.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I'll have to get you back to talk about that another time.
I think I'm sort of done with that.
Well, no, I just think that is very thought-provoking. Thank you, Angus. Now, I've got to ask you a couple of quick questions before we finish.
Okay.
How did you meet Darcy? I've got to talk about Darcy.
Yeah, why not?
Go on then. How did you meet her?
She was my next-door neighbour. We had one-bedroom flats in a street called Harcourt Terrace in Brompton in West London. And we met. It was something like the 21st of December, 1991. And I was having a Christmas drinks party that night with some mates from the city and stuff. And I was carrying a honey roast ham because my culinary skills were to have a honey roast ham, a chopped up baguettes, and a sharp knife. And it was help yourself. That was it. And then there was a big tub of beer. And that was the drinks party. It was a foggy evening and Darcy had a suitcase and some friends helping her and she was moving in. So she was walking in up her entrance with a suitcase. I was walking up with a honey roast ham and I said to her, come along tonight or excuse the noise. Mm. And that's how we met.
Did you know who she was?
Absolutely not.
Nah.
And that was a real blessing.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'd fluff it if I tried to approach somebody, you know, that you really fancy. I think I'd trip over my tongue and my words.
Yeah.
Genuine question, sounds flippant, but is it difficult sometimes being married to someone famous? Because I always think, you know, everyone thinks it'd be a nice idea. I'd quite like to marry Kylie Minogue, but actually the reality of it would be pretty awful. I would have thought traveling a lot, everywhere she goes, people are interested in her, sticking a camera up your nose and, you know, whatever. Is it tough or are you long resigned to it and unable to deal with it?
Well, Stuart, let's talk about Kylie for a second because, first of all, she's single.
She hasn't called. Right. I'm gutted. She's obviously lost my number.
I'll put a word in if you'd like.
Oh, do you know Kylie?
We don't actually.
Oh,
but Darcy.
You have my hopes.
Darcy Vlessa can get to most people
okay,
if she wants
well,
to.
If she could put in a word, that would be greatly appreciated. No, but in all seriousness, I think that would be really tough, wouldn't it?
No, that's very kind. I think certainly for some people of fame, it would be really tough. Mm. Where we were blessed was, as far as I was concerned, with regard to Darcy being well known, is that she was a ballet dancer. So she was of the high arts. You know, it's a very Spartan sport, ballet. You don't get paid any money. And also, when she was at her most famous as a ballerina, people knew her name and they didn't know her face.
Okay.
So if you were playing Trivial Pursuit and someone said, name a ballerina, you'd say
Darcy Bustle
or Margot Fontaine.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know the face.
You wouldn't know the face.
Hey, but that's changed with Strictly. I mean, everyone knows her now.
And then with Strictly, she did 7 seasons of Strictly. The reason why she did Strictly was because she was very pro-dance. She wants everyone to dance, and that's a pro-dance show. And funny enough, you know, it's been a little while since she stopped that now. It must be 4 years or something. Quite often they know her voice. She'll be on the tube and they'll hear this voice because we're chatting and they'll turn around. But people are incredibly respectful, you know, and the Brits, we're reserved, aren't we? You know, my Australian side comes out, I'm not so reserved, but, you know, the British are typically reserved. They're very polite, very respectful as a race for Darcy. And also she doesn't court attention and that's a huge thing.
Yeah,
if you're well known.
Yeah. I think you can't have it both ways. If you caught the attention, you can't then complain about the attention.
Exactly.
But she doesn't
caught it. And I think it was Shirley MacLaine who her girlfriend asked her that. And she was on Oxford Street, funnily enough, Shirley MacLaine, at a height of her powers. And she said, you know, what do you do about fame? She said, well, watch this. She turned up the corner of her Macintosh and she turned towards the window of whatever shop they were out on Oxford Street. And she walked slowly along. No one noticed in the world. She put down her Macintosh coil. She opened up her shoulders. She turned to the people and said everyone, like that. Yeah. And everyone, oh my goodness, it's Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah.
So it's very much up to the celebrity how they want to play the game.
Yeah.
And Darcy is a very modest and humble person. And so she doesn't do hardly any social media. She speaks infrequently. She doesn't do much press. And also, you know, we're getting older now as well. She's not on the telly every day and things like that. So it's all pretty cool.
She handles it very well. And she was very relaxed when she met Stuart Elford. She didn't get starstruck at all. I don't know how she held herself back. But
she was deep breathing outside the studio, calming. Well, she came in.
Well, she very kindly made me a cup of tea and we shared pictures of our dogs.
Oh,
so she's all right by me. I have to say, she's very lovely.
Well, thank you.
And was she anything to do with getting The Devil Wears Prada here as the world premiere that's coming, Elton John's?
Thank you, absolutely not.
Okay.
James McKenzie Blackman and the board and Liz King, who's the head of production, they were responsible for that. I think having Darcy Bustle as your chair with the incredible Bronwyn Lacey as a deputy chair allows the confidence of the team maybe a little bit more leeway. You know, you've got Darcy Bustle in your corner. And I think Darcy carries it with her value set that people really resonate towards. But talking about Devil Wears Prada, I mean, the artists opened with this gala night last night.
It blew me away.
That's great. I've
tweeted, blogged, posted about how absolutely amazing it was.
And we've made productions, I believe, here in Plymouth before under Adrian Vinken's reign, which is wonderful. And James wants to take that legacy and raise it £10. So the opening gambit for him was the artist. And The Devil Wears Prada is a different beast. It will also be produced here, but it's actually its second iteration. The first iteration of Devil Wears Prada on the stage didn't go so well.
I didn't know that.
Mm. So they've decided to double down and come to TR2 and remake it.
Yeah.
So with Elton's music, which it was in the first version, so that's why Elton will come to town as well in order to work on the production. And again, we'll be able to use the full facilities of TR2 and then the show will be opened at TRP.
I understand James McKenzie Blackman, who's just fantastic and he's so eloquent. He's such a bundle of joy. I love James. He let the Americans know that Plymouth is the fashion capital of the world. And, you know, Americans believe it. And here we are. We're going to have The Devil Wears Prada world premiere in Plymouth, along with the artist.
Just to expand on that story for one second, if I may.
Yeah.
So he was in the interview process for The Devil Wears Prada because they had a lot of other production units vying for it. And they turned to him and said, give us one reason why Plymouth. And he thought, oh my God, I have to think on my feet. So he thought, I'm just going to make them laugh. And he said, because Plymouth is the fashion capital of the world. They laughed so much, they said, we have to give it to you. So it's brilliant improvisation by him.
He's a very interesting guy. I interviewed him on the podcast and I hadn't met him before he came in. And he was just so open and warm and eloquent, really enjoyed his company.
Yeah, it's a great guy.
As I have with you. Thank you, Angus. Sure. And it's been an absolute delight. And you've really opened up some very thought-provoking conversations, which I'm sure our listeners will love. And thank you very much for joining us, Angus Forbes.
Stuart, thank you very much for having me.
In Conversation With is supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors, supporting Southwest individuals and businesses for over 30 years. Westcott's, we're here. Produced by Fresh Air Studios, full audio and video production services for business podcasts and corporate events. Visit freshairstudios.com. Presented by Stuart Elford. Produced by Paul Philpott. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video production by Mark Stevenson. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Copyright Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce and Fresh Air Studios Limited. All rights reserved.